Welcome to Amateur Radio Topics. I'm Kevin, VK6 Lima Whiskey, and today I'm joined by Steve, VK6 Whiskey Zulu in Western Canada, and we're going to have a chat about some of Steve's experiments and results with BOGs for the LF, primarily for the LF band. So good morning, Steve.
Yes, good morning, Kevin, and thanks a lot for inviting me. I do enjoy your show, by the way. You know, you had mentioned to me the, you know, you had mentioned you'd watch my YouTube channel occasionally, and then you made the comment to me that, you know, the podcast is, you know, it's a different format, and I've got to tell you, I do appreciate it. Specifically, it's a 100-kilometer drive to my remote station. It's about an hour and a half. Your podcast is perfect for my drive. Yes. You know, I'll load it on Spotify, and it's really it's a perfect venue for that. Especially since my wife isn't in the car. I mean, she I'm sorry, Kevin, but she's got very little interest in ham radio in terms of having listening to you yammer on about radio.
Yeah, I have the same thing, and occasionally we jump into the car, and for whatever reason, for no apparent reason. But as soon as I turn the radio on, my podcast is there on the coming through on the Bluetooth via my phone. And my wife Julie, she said, "Oh no, turn all this off. You know, let's find a radio station or something."
So the eyes start rolling.
She's very tolerant. But she certainly doesn't really want to listen to the podcast. Having said that, the most recent podcast I've just completed was. A little bit of a story about how I came to acquire my latest paddle, my latest Morse key, which is a Bigali from Italy. And it's a very nice paddle. And Julie was instrumental in me acquiring that paddle because we visited a guy in the Bailiwicks Island, EA6EJ, Innie, and he had a Bigali on his desk. And I operated there for a very brief period, maybe 45 minutes. One morning when we called in to see him, and then we went off and had a coffee. And I commented how nice the Bigali was, what a nice paddle it was. You could sit down. It was just felt very seamless straight away. And Julie obviously picked up on this, and unbeknownst to me, once we got back to Australia, she contacted Bigali in Italy, and she ordered me a very nice Bigali signature dual lever paddle, iambic paddle, which turned up a few months later. So, and that was partly an anniversary present. So she is not only sympathetic to my hobby, but she does support me in the hobby. She just doesn't need to listen to the podcast, really. she listened to that last podcast because she was involved. So that was a bit different. Anyway, but I think one of the things with the podcast, and I did listen to some podcasts, and one of the things I quite like about it is I can listen in the car, I can listen if I'm on a walk. I can listen if I'm on a bicycle or whatever. It's something you can listen to while you're doing something else. Whereas, obviously, with the YouTube video, they're more informative and they're more instructive, and you've got the visual, but you have to watch it. You can't just wander off and do something else.
Exactly.
So sometimes, you know, quite often I have podcasts on when I'm in the workshop doing something, maybe not radio-related podcasts, but it's just something else. I've got the podcast in the background. And I'm busily involved building antennas or whatever I'm up to. So yes, I certainly was interested in the videos that I've watched the last few days about the BOG and the BOL and the results you've had with them, because I had a BOG and I had some mixed results with it, but I was only really using a traditional input transport. A traditional transform interface, you know, with the binocular core, no preamp. I just use the preamp on the radio. RG6 feed line, similar to what you're using. And it had enough gain that it was useful. I had it running north for the JAs. And it was certainly okay. It was about 280 feet long, so similar to yours, about 300. And it was just resting on the top of the rocky soil. And bearing in mind, we've got not good ground conductivity here. The soil is just all rock on top of the hill. It seemed to work okay, but the preamp no doubt would help. So maybe for our listeners, you can explain a little bit more about what you've been doing with your BOGs and how you've you've developed a new antenna. I never even thought of a BOL before, so I'll let you explain what you've been up to.
Well, sure, Kevin. That's great. And yeah, I think that perhaps the most important thing that drove me, the main thing that drove me even in the direction to try a BOG was the nightmare of maintenance of my above ground wires. I mean, I had, you know, 4 kilometers of above ground wire running through my forest. Now, I live on the top of this large hill and I'm surrounded by farmland. But if you look at an aerial view, you can see that it's all trees on the top of this hill, but everywhere else the land is cleared. Obviously, it's farmland. And the point is, because this land is on a hill, it wasn't really farmable. And so consequently, these trees are what I call old growth. It's mixed deciduous conifers, and they've never been cleared. And so they're really tired old trees. And so many dead ones that honestly, after every single windstorm, even a slight windstorm, I would have trees down. And with that many wires, I was constantly needing to take the 100-kilometer drive to my remote to repair the wires. Now, I did anticipate this to a degree, and I thought I was really clever with my above-ground installation with these wires, because I had counterweights and pulleys. So if a tree fell using this heavy galvanized steel fence wire, the wires would not break, which was great. So from that standpoint, it worked. The problem is, of course, once a tree's down on the wire, it does affect its performance. But from a responsibility standpoint of, you know, not impacting wildlife or any humans that might walk through the forest, because of course, if a log is, if a tree's on a wire, someone could, you know, clothesline themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. I felt compelled, all right, if you're following me here, that I needed to repair these. it was a nightmare, Kevin. I swear to God, it was almost weekly, certainly.
So, and you had you had 4 kilometers of wire?
Yeah. 4,000 meters of wire. Well, I had 15 beverage wires, and they're 1,000-foot wires in all directions, broadside, phased pairs, and whatnot. So, yeah. I literally, at one point, I came home and I told my wife, I said, this has got to end. I mean, I can't keep doing this, right? So that was what drove me to say, okay, I need another solution. However, I love my beverages. I mean, they were the most effective antenna. I mean, they yeah. did outperform my 9-circle receive array, though not so much the single wires, but I had broadside pairs, and those were really exceptional performers. So I said, okay, well, what can I do? And of course, I knew about BOGs. I'd heard about BOGs. Personally, inwardly, I thought, that's got to be a crap antenna. I mean, how can a wire lying in the ground be any good? Now, it's not that I hadn't talked to a number of people that have said and have told me that a low wire, okay, as well as a beverage right on the ground, they do work, okay? So that was enough to say, okay, let's give it a try. So I thought, well, I'm gonna give it a go. But I did mention in one of my videos that I also was aware of Rudy Severin's N6LF's paper, where he had done some work that showed that a BOG as it ages and sinks into the ground and gets covered by overgrowth, that not only will the output become diminished, but you can tend to lose directivity. And I think that he describes it more better than I do, but you know, it begins to self-terminate and there can be.
Yeah. I read that paper some time ago. Yeah.
So I thought, well, okay, maybe I don't want it on the ground. And I thought, well, how about if I elevate it? And of course, right away, as soon as it's slightly elevated, okay, you're going to say, well, I mean, you know, the animals are going to trip on them and rip them out, and that won't work. And I thought, well, okay, just during a walk through the forest, fixing some of my above ground wires, I see all this deadfall. And I mean, I've got just so much deadfall. I thought, well, why don't, what if I just staple the wire to the logs? Because after all, if you, most deer, I mean, they're lazy. They don't want to step on something, so they just walk over it.
Yeah.
And so that's what moved me toward, okay, let's just put a wire on a log and see how it works. Now, right away, though, I thought, well, the output is likely to be low. And so what can I do about that? And that is the other part of the story here. And that is for at least a year, perhaps 2 years prior, I had been in contact with John W1FV. And he's the father and designer of the Nine Circle Receive Array. And he had developed a new transimpedance amplifier specifically for his Nine Circle Receive Array. Because his original amplifier design, quasi-unity gain, it's really an impedance buffer, but we all realized using that particular amplifier that it really didn't lift the gain enough to avoid the need of another amplifier prior to the radio. So he developed this design, and I purchased some from him, and he was very kind to share his schematic of his design so that I could redesign the PCB to more suit my application on my verticals. All right.
Yeah.
So I had this, and they worked exceptional. I mean, they're really a remarkable amplifier. They're extremely low noise and very stable in impedance and phase, and very immune to IMD. So I had the ability, and I had these amplifiers in hand, and then it occurred to me, can I make this work with the BOG? Well, the only issue is that the input impedance to the amplifier in the case of a short vertical is a very high impedance, and these amplifiers were designed for that. The impedance of the verticals are like, you know, 1600 ohms, so a very high impedance input. Without a very high impedance input, for the, if this amplifier doesn't see a very high impedance, it gets crushed. But communicating with John, we sort of concluded that perhaps the best approach would be just to include some series capacitance to bring up that impedance if attached to a BOG, and it should work. And so that led me to experiment with that. And it works like a darn. I mean, it is attached to the BOGs. I did a little bit of experimenting. I basically just, you know, tried different input capacitance with the amplifier and found a value that works very well. And it is remarkable in terms of how it lifts the gain of these wires. The perhaps other benefit, now, you could likely, and many people do, drive a BOG without an amplifier, as you did, and achieve enough gain. I mean, you could amplify it on the low impedance side before the radio, and you'd probably be okay as well. So, but for myself, the secondary benefit was because I phase my arrays, I have two beverages phased in phase in a broadside configuration. When you phase anything with coax, it's vital that the SWR, okay, on that feed line be 1-to-1. If it's not, the phasing will not be accurate. So the benefit of these amplifiers is that it normalizes and maintains an exact 75 ohm impedance at each wire. So therefore, it's perfect for phasing both broadside and end fire, which I've done. So sorry, that's kind of a long story, but that's really how it all happened.
Well, no, that's a good explanation of how you've managed to get to where you are with this system. And you're correct, the BOG or the BOG. I've spoken to other people about this, and they've maybe tried and not had much success, and maybe not try with the preamplifier in the same way that you have, obviously, just use the preamplifier on the radio. And of course, I think it also depends a little bit on the ground conductivity. It's quite possible if you if you're on highly conductive clay soil, the wire close to ground may not work as well. If you're on I'm on very rocky soil here, you can't drive a ground rod in. Those I saw those copper pipes you were using that you were driving into the ground. I think 4 foot long, the half inch copper pipe.
Yes.
You can't do that here. The thing just crumples up when you get about you get about 6 inches down. It just crumples up. You've got to pre-dig a hole, essentially, to get those in and make sure there's no big rocks underneath. And I've actually used. There's another product here that I've been able to buy from the hardware store, which is a it's a solid steel rod with a copper cladding. And they use it for earth rods typically. For housing and that sort of thing, and they're about 6 foot long. But it's very unusual for me to find a spot where I can drive something down to 3 to 4 feet. It's just the soil is just ridiculous. So, in that sense, the soil is very non-conductive where I am, and I think maybe that helps me with the BOG that I was using. Whereas Steve VK6VZ, who lives over the hill from me. He's very close to a stream. The ground's quite conductive. The ground's quite sort of wet. And he put a bog or BOG down and it was completely hopeless. He had no success with it whatsoever. So, but of course, in your instance, by elevating it maybe, I don't know, 12 inches or 30 centimetres in the air on a log, you maybe get around all those close to ground issues that I've just been talking about.
Yes, absolutely, Kevin. And I think you're absolutely correct. And I think that your lower conductivity soil would absolutely improve, in my opinion, the performance of a BOG. In fact, you could probably get away with it being directly on the ground.
Mine was just on the ground.
Yeah,
and the ground's essentially just gravel. I mean, there's a bit of undergrowth there, but because the ground quality is so poor and there's very little topsoil, the ground cover's quite low. And we have kangaroos coming around grazing all the time, and that keeps the level of the bush at a fairly low, a low amount. I mean, if you don't have kangaroos, then obviously all this stuff will grow more, but the kangaroos do a pretty good job. They're a bit like sheep. They just wander around and they clean everything up. So, but they are a problem, of course, with, as you were just discussing with deer and whatever, we have the same problem with the kangaroos. So you can't have low wires. The wires have got to be at least 6 foot high, preferably 7 or 8 foot high. Otherwise you're going to run into problems.
Well, that's exactly what my above ground wires were, but you're correct. I mean, it's been well described that, and it's been attempted many times on D expeditions. Okay. To Pacific Island D expeditions where you're proximal to the ocean with salt saturated water, salt saturated, ground, beverages, even above the ground are dismal. I mean, they're basically dead, and they're dead because basically you're feeding a shorted feed line, okay? Mm. Because basically a beverage is a feed line. I mean, it's like a piece of twin lead. The above ground wire is one side of the feed line, and the ground is the other side. And if the ground conductivity is perfect, you're basically got a shorted feed line. So, but the other benefit, Kevin, to your setup, and in a way. A benefit of these transimpedance amplifiers. You see, the amplifier, these amplifiers are looking for a high impedance feed point. Hmm. So that's the beauty of it. You can get away with, let's call it a somewhat crappy ground. Okay, not zero. You do need a ground of some sort because it's relative to the antenna, right? But you don't need a really good ground in order to drive the input of the amplifier, right? The high impedance is actually a good thing. So I think that your type of terrain would be well suited.
With your BOLs, I notice you have a ground rod and it's 3 to 4 feet long, whatever. Is that the only grounding, or do you lay out some radials from that ground rod away from the direction of the BRL?
No, no, nothing. Just the
no
ground
radials.
rod.
No.
No.
Okay.
And again, that's that's the same with the high impedance verticals, the short verticals in my 9-circle receive array, or any of the what we call high Z short vertical arrays. They're all the same. They're fed at the high impedance point with just a ground rod, no radials.
Okay.
In fact, radials in the case of a short vertical will, upset the pattern more than anything.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
No radials at all, Kevin. It's just,
okay,
just ground rod.
I found with the traditional beverages I've got here, which are the normal sort of 600 foot, 150 meter long beverage for 160 and 80, and with the difficulty in putting in a decent ground rod, I've actually dispensed with the ground rods altogether, and I just have three 10 meter radials radiating out from either end of the beverage, so at the feed point end and also the terminating end. And that does seem to help the performance of the beverage on my soil, because it's giving it, there is some grounding there for traditional beverage.
Yeah, that's a great solution. I mean, basically you're capacitively coupling to the earth.
That's right. It's just a relative, it's a relative, it's like a counterpoise, counterpoise for the beverage. The BOG, I did the same thing. I didn't have a termination of the firing, because I figured that the antenna was, from what I could gather from the literature that I read, the antennas are essentially self-terminating. Now, I don't know if you found that with your BRLs. Did you find they were self-terminating, or did you terminate at the far end?
Oh, okay. No, I with my BOGs or BOLs, they're only elevated maybe 6 or maybe 8 inches at the most. It depends on how thick the log was or how the diameter. I mean, they undulate, they wobble through the forest, but nominally about, say, 6 to 8 inches. Perhaps because they're elevated that much, I don't think that at 300 to 400 feet, which is how long my wires ended up being, they are not self-terminating. And I know that because, first of all, listening to the radio, there was a huge difference when they were terminated. I mean, it was okay. Just a whole, but more importantly, sweeping it with the analyzer. I mean, the key to sweeping it, to know when you've got the proper termination, when you sweep with the analyzer, it will be flat SWR. Okay, not one to one, depending on your input impedance, but there'll be very few undulations, and that's because the wire is terminated in its characteristic impedance, like a feed line. So therefore, the SWR, as it were, on that feed line is flat. I did not see that. Okay, without termination, it was just wildly wobbling around. As soon as I terminated it in around 300 ohms, in my case, the SWR went perfectly flat. So if you're following me, clearly they were not self-terminating.
Yeah, no, that's good. Look, it's very interesting. I think there's obviously a lot of merit in that antenna, and it's a very practical antenna from the point of view of, I mean, I could envisage here putting up BOGs again. I could give these antennas a try. I'm very interested in the preamplifier idea. I've got 2.5 acres. I've got plenty of space, and actually, with the size you're talking about, the length of the 300 feet, it would be quite easy for me to configure those as a phase pair. I've got enough room to do that. With the elevated beverages, it's actually quite difficult for me to create a phase pair situation, because there's just too many things that are in the way.
Do you know, Kevin, I as soon as you said that, I must tell you that is largely, partly at least, what compelled me to make the videos that I did, both on the BOG as well as the amplifiers. And that's because exactly what you said. I really feel this BOG approach is accessible to a lot of people that normally the above ground BOG, the above ground wires wouldn't be. Hey, BOGs aren't new. I mean, I realize that, but I guess that's the the other thing that compelled me to make the video was I was so impressed, Kevin. I have to tell you, I was truly surprised. I'm sincerely surprised at the performance. And my point here is I'm not coming from, you know, like, this is the first receive antenna I've ever built. I mean, over 30 years, I've built a lot of different receive antennas. And I mean, as I said, I had an array of 15 elevated beverage wires covering the whole compass directions and broadside pairs. And so, you know, I'm comparing it to a lot of different receive antennas. And I was frankly shocked. I didn't expect them to perform as well as they do. And this might sound like a bold statement, but honestly, the more I've been progressing with these, and I've had them now here for over a year, two seasons now, in some ways, they're outperforming the performance I was seeing from my above ground wires. And if I may, I'll just maybe touch on another thing I did. And because, you know, here I am talking about on-air performance, and I frankly feel there's perhaps a little bit too much of that goes on in our community, in our ham community, about, you know, just quantifying antenna performance based on what I can hear. I mean, what else do we have? Well, we do have other approaches, right? But just saying you can hear DX and this antenna works great, or I can work a lot of DX, that's not really proof that your antenna is working. I mean, any better than, say, someone else? Because, I mean, it could be depend on location. It could depend on a lot of
things. Yeah, there's so many factors. And yes, I completely agree with that. I mean, I spent a lot of time over the years modeling antennas. So I think the last count, I've modeled more than 700 antennas using NEC. Just for fun, let's model this one. Let's have a look at this one, see what this one does. Obviously, I hadn't built all of those 700 antennas, because the whole idea of the modeling is to try and figure out what is really going to work and what isn't going to work. And although I'm a 160 meter enthusiast and I really enjoy the band, I'm also pretty keen on the HF bands and very keen on contesting. So a lot of what I sometimes do with the modeling is driven towards trying to develop antennas that can maximize what I've got here at my disposal from a contesting perspective. One of the traps that I've fallen into in the past is that I might model an antenna, I might put it up, it might seem to be working really well outside of contest conditions. And then you get into a contest and the band noise is elevated by 10 or 20 dBs on both ends of the path because of all the QRM. And all of a sudden the antenna doesn't work anywhere near as well as you would hope it would, because you're operating under a very noisy band. So it's all completely relative to the band conditions, you know, the signal to noise ratio, and what you really expect from the antenna. And the modeling is really useful. It gets you in the ballpark. I've got to the stage now with the modeling where I feel that if I model it correctly and I build it correctly, generally speaking, it works. It works the way I think it should work. But it's very subjective, and it's dependent on location, and it's dependent on conditions, and it's dependent on the received capability of the person at the other end, and a whole bunch of things. So you probably also had the experience, as I have, of being going on the band and with an antenna, whether it's transmit or receive, and really feeling that the antenna is working based on your past experiences. You get that feeling, yes, I feel loud, or I'm hearing this station very well, whereas in the past, maybe, you know, the signal to noise ratio on that path or whatever wasn't so great. So they're all quite incremental things that are hard to explain to somebody that hasn't had maybe the same experience with antennas. And of course, everybody that either puts up an antenna or buys an antenna wants to say it's working quite well. Otherwise, you know, they've either wasted their money or wasted all their effort, I guess.
don't want to admit it. Right.
Exactly. It's like somebody that buys the latest rig and says, well, it's the best rig I've ever had. I'm hearing stuff on this rig I've never heard before. Well, that's a big claim, because most of the newish radios these days, all the receivers are pretty good. There's, you know, the there's not a lot to choose between. And yes, obviously there's good receivers and bad receivers, and there's receivers that suffer from IMD and they're more prone to interference or whatever. But yes, you do get that a little bit whereby, you know, obviously you don't want to feel that what you've invested your money in or what you've invested your time in is not going to work. But you also have to be subjective about it, particularly with antennas. You've got to be honest with what you're hearing and the results you're getting. So
that's human nature. But I'm. Let me just describe briefly how I did evaluate these, though, because I have taken a less than subjective approach to really, you know, when I say I really am impressed with the performance. Oh, yes, I am impressed based on just what I hear. Okay. But I've done more than that. Okay. At least three different approaches. Well, four, if you just include basically listening on 160 meters. Okay. And seeing the performance in terms of what I can hear. One approach is actually recording RBN reception, okay, from my own skimmers. I have three RBN skimmers, okay, three skimmer radios, and they all have different names. If you look at the RBN, you'll see a V6WZ, a V6WZ1, and a V6WZ2. Each one of those skimmer radios is connected to a different antenna. All right. It specifically, for example, in the early days, I had an Omni on one of the skimmer radios, and I had my above ground beverages, okay, on one, say pointing to Europe, and then my BOGs pointing to Europe, okay, if you're following me. Now, my skimmer, okay, it's going to skim the same spots out of Europe, okay? Yeah. Carl, OK1CF is calling CQ. Literally, what is his signal to noise ratio in dB comparing those two antennas? All right. So that's fairly objective. Yes, and most of the time, the BOG, virtually all of the time, the BOGs kept up. Okay. There was no difference. The second approach I use, and I had talked to you about this earlier, I have three Perseus radios, and those radios can record the entire medium wave band, all right? And I was able to do the same thing, that is to say, record the entire medium wave band, say on my VKZL beverage pair, on my above ground wires, and on the BOGs. And then I could listen to 4BH Brisbane on 1116 kilohertz, right? And compare on medium wave the two signals, because I can go back in time, I can listen to it and compare them. Okay, the BOGs were keeping up with the above ground 1,000 foot wires compared to 300 foot.
That's a big difference, basically. Well, you're down on 1116.
Yeah, I mean, they're way short.
yeah, it's a very short antenna for that frequency. That's a good indication.
And then the third thing I did was flew my drone. Okay.
Yeah, I saw that. It's very interesting.
So I built a signal source using a clock oscillator for the medium wave band, as well as for 160 meters, right? And I built a very light little clock oscillator powered by some batteries dangling under my little Mavic Mini drone. Okay, it's light enough that it could lift this thing with about a 15-foot piece of wire, right? The source is in between the wires, right? It's like a vertical dipole hanging under my drone. So I send the drone out to a kilometer away, sort of out close to being outside the near field of the array. And I fly it to an elevation where I'm close to representing a 15-degree wave angle, okay? And then I plot my azimuth, because I model all of my arrays and all of my beverages. I plot it at a 15-degree wave angle. So I'll fly my drone with that signal source out to eight different locations circling my location and switch through all of my antennas and actually record, okay, the exact dB level. And then I plot it up on a polar plot. So I'm actually measuring, okay, the far field pattern of my BOGs, and I show this on my my YouTube channel, but it's I was very surprised at the how accurately they represented the modeling, except for, and this is another thing that very much surprised me, was the side rejection. Specifically, both on 160 meters and on medium wave, the side rejection, that is to say the broadness of the forward lobe, was very much more narrow than was modeled. Okay, in other words, somehow the modeling, this is an example where the modeling actually was in what it appears as though the modeling was under evaluating these BODs.
I saw that on the YouTube video. Yes.
Yeah, the most important parameter for a receive antenna is the RDF, received directivity factor, and of course modeling will give you that number. And the RDF, especially with my broadside pairs of these BOGs, is very good. But with this, when I see the drone data, it would suggest that perhaps the RDF is even better, okay, than the modeling would suggest. Because if the forward lobe is even more narrow, you know, that would enhance the RDF even more. And I see this, okay, on performance. Okay, for example, if Sweden is coming in, I have a broadside pair of these BOGs at 21 degrees. Okay, that's directly at Northern Europe. And I have another pair at 45 degrees. Okay, so not a big difference. Okay, both beverage pairs. I won't even hear Sweden on the 45 degree pair. So, you know, you're only moving a number of degrees to 21 degrees, and it's a perfect copy, all right? Yeah. So, anyway, I'm kind of rambling on, but my point is, when I say that I've been impressed with these BOGs, it's based on not just hearing stuff, but also based on measurement and whatnot.
Yeah, no, I can see that that's a pretty forensic examination of the antenna. There's not too many people that I know using the drones. I've got a drone. I've got the same drone that you have, actually, the Mini Maverick. I've not built a small oscillator to try this out, but it's a good idea. It's a really good idea.
I got a YouTube video on that, Kevin. If you want to watch it,
I'm going to go and check that out. Actually, it's very interesting. You mentioned to me before you were doing it, and I thought, yeah, it's a good application for the drone. I've used the drone for a couple of other things that it's probably not designed for, and that's dropping lines over tall trees. And it will in fact do it. You know, I came up with a mechanism that I could quick release mechanism. I could attach to the underside of the drone and drop a small fishing weight over the top of a tree. But the drone is probably not quite big enough to deal with the extra load, and it sort of tends to make it a little bit unstable. But it worked. It did work. And I've managed to complete the mission without the drone becoming entangled in the uppermost branches of the tree, which was the main object of the exercise, really. So, yeah. Very, very, they're useful devices, drones. It's very good, Steve. Yes, look, I've enjoyed watching the videos, and your explanation of them is excellent. And I think for anybody that's got a degree of space, even if you've only got maybe a smaller block of land, half an acre or something, you can actually fit these BOGs in at 300 feet or 100 meters. It wouldn't be too hard. Whether or not you can fit a phase pair, it's another story, but at least even a single wire is going to be some improvement on the LF bands in terms of signal to noise ratio. It's very good. And I think also the further explanation that you had, and this may be something we need to leave for another podcast, but the amplifiers that you've built and the details of the printed circuit boards and the process that you go through with those, that's quite good. Having, obviously, you could replicate that circuit without a printed circuit board, but the fact that boards were available and you've made some of that information available is also very good indeed. So, Just to point out, Steve does have a really good YouTube channel with lots of interesting antenna information on it. So it's worth checking out the 6WZ YouTube. And there's a mine of information on there, which will give you some great ideas, I'm sure, with your antenna experiments.
Yeah, it's I sometimes not sure how well received my channel is. I mean, I can see I get a number of views, but you know, it's a fairly niche channel. Some of your listeners may know I'm kind of marooned on the low bands. I'm not kind of a kind of rarely get above 40 meters, as it were. But so most of my content is related to you know, the low frequencies, 160 meters and otherwise. But yeah, I mean, it's Kevin, I think that basically I just like to build stuff. I mean, for me, the hobby, the ham radio hobby for me is I enjoy operating equally as much as I like to build stuff. And, you know, that's why I put my YouTube channel together. I would often sort of on some other email lists and whatnot, comment about some of the things I've built. And oh, so many times it that leads to a whole bunch of emails. How did you do this? And how do you do that? Yeah, and that leads to a whole bunch of emails. And that's what drove me to make YouTube. So I thought, well, why don't I just make a YouTube? Yeah. And then just, you know, when someone asks me a question, I just send them the link.
Yeah. Descriptive. I mean, obviously you've got the video there as well, and it's well put together. It's very interesting stuff. I've always enjoyed building various antenna various antenna projects and accessories for station, that sort of thing. I'm way past building my own gear, which I used to do back in the early days when funds were very limited. But I still enjoy getting involved with what I can. The other week I repaired the Expert SPE 2K linear, the input and the output relays have just about given up, and I had no copy on receive when I would go from transmit to receive because the relays had failed, and a little bit of research on the net, it didn't appear to be an uncommon problem. And it's a beautifully made linear. It's a wonderful piece of engineering. It's not the easiest linear to actually get apart and extract the boards and ultimately replace the offending relays, but I managed it in the end. So that was an interesting project to get into that, and to be able to, you know, perform that small service routine, which probably you need to complete every, with the use I give the linear with contests and whatever, I probably need to replace those relays about every 6 to 7 years, I would say, based on other people's experiences.
Well, that's great that you have the ability to do that. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. I've had a bit of a problem with my ACOM, but you know, there's always something, isn't there, Kevin?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and you know,
it's part of the hobby, really.
Well,
it keeps you interested.
It is, but at the same time, I remember I was on a local chat on 80 meters with some of the local guys, and we're talking about my remote, and this one fellow, you know, kind of suggested, oh yeah, I'd like to build a remote one day, and my only advice to him was, if you're going to build a remote, A, you better really like building stuff, and you better really like fixing stuff, because that's what it is. And I sincerely mean that. In other words, you know, it's a little different than just, I don't want to say an appliance operator, but if you have to actually enjoy it, because otherwise it would soon, you might soon abandon it, because there's, it's always something, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I find here with the single operator two radio setup that I've got for contests, and two towers, and essentially two lots of antennas and the receive antennas as well, and most of my antennas are wire antennas that always have been. I quite enjoy building wire antennas and wire beams and all that sort of thing. And so consequently, there's an unending list of maintenance issues that whether it's a hardware issue with a tower, whether it's an antenna issue, or I'm modding something new. And from time to time, the comment does get, I do get the comment from Julie, well, when would this be finished? When will you finish this antenna? I said, well, I'll get this antenna finished, but there's going to be another antenna after this, something else I might design and develop and decide to put up and test. And I said, but that's part of the hobby. That's part of what has kept me in the hobby for, actually, this year I'll be licensed for 49 years, which is, sounds like a long time.
I think I'm the same. I think yeah. I'm the same. I'd have to do the math. I think well, I might be up to 50.
Yeah, I was, you know, when I got my license, I was only 16 in the UK. So
I was we're the same. I was 15 years old, and I was licensed in 1973. So that's 50 years.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you're just a bit ahead of me. But no, I think that the interest in building and designing and developing, whether it's antennas or equipment or whatever it is something that will keep me in the hobby. And also CW's kept me in the hobby as well. I love CW. And I still love to do contests. I love to do contests, not because I'm going to win the contest necessarily, not going to win much from VK6, but because I enjoy being part of the contest weekends. You know, it's just a fun, I have fun on my contest. And
it's exciting.
And that can be hard to explain to some people. It can be even hard to explain to some people within the amateur radio community. But never try to explain why you find a contest fun to somebody that knows nothing about amateur radio, because obviously they think you're quite strange. I try and avoid that subject when we mix with other people, and because it's just impossible to explain why I would enjoy that, staying up for 48 hours continuously on a secret worldwide weekend or something.
Well, Kevin. It is kind of strange.
Yeah, it is, and it's and now and again, Julie will deliberately almost bring this subject up in mixed company, and of course, you can't give a one word answer to this. Once the subject is raised and people start asking you questions, you dig yourself into an even deeper hole.
Because they're not going to get it.
No, they don't get it. They simply cannot get it, and so consequently. I've found a way of doing it now, which creates a bit of fun, and I don't take it too seriously, and I'll point out to them that it's just a hobby, and you know, when things go wrong, which they will do, the reason we're called radio amateurs is because we're not professionals. It's amateur radio. This is what we do. So, but anyway, look, most people, our close friends, understand what goes on now. This is more to do with, you know, if you're meeting people for the first time or whatever. And Julie might bring that. Oh, tell them about your hobby and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, no, please don't. Let's just not go there. Let's talk about something else.
That same happens to me. Yeah, don't bring it up. It's truly, to most people, Kevin, it's truly tinfoil hat stuff.
Yeah. So, but that's okay. Look, we have fun with it. And this has been a really good podcast, Steve. We could definitely do another one. I think we could probably do something a little bit more about those amplifiers and also your switching systems with the antennas that you've got. I did touch on that a little bit on your podcast, on your YouTube. I had a look at that, but I think we could do another podcast maybe in a month or so's time and cover some of those switching systems, some of the infrastructure you've got on the remote and.
You know what, Kevin? Yes. I just when you mentioned that, I'm actually, that is going to be my next video that I'm making. And that's regarding switching, because actually there's a new software version of the switching program that I use for direction switching. And it's quite exciting because it eliminates entirely the need for the diode matrix associated with these relay boards. So, okay. Yes, let's stay tuned on that. I'd be glad to chat with you about that.
Yeah, that would be really good. And then by that stage, I may have the antennas back up. I may be back at 160. I've got a, it's not just a question of fixing the low band antennas. I had a fault on the 168 meter feed line, which is of my own making. I didn't put enough strain relief on the center insulator and the coax center fracture. And it's just one of those things. So I'm fixing that up, but at the same time, I'm also repairing and redesigning and redeveloping. I've got a different antenna for the HF bands now. I've got an X beam, a 2/2 X beam for 2015 and 10, but it's a lot of wire. And I've got a new spreader system at the top now. And the X beams are stacked 2/2 and they're phased. And I put that up specifically for CQ Worldwide, but because I didn't have the LF bands, I never ended up really using those antennas for that contest. I just ended up doing the 40-meter single band and shelved the rest of it. But in the short period of time that I had that 2/2 antenna up and working, it appeared to be very good, and it also supported the modelling that I did on that 2/2 X beam. So I'm quite keen to get it back up again, do a bit more testing. As soon as you start putting stacked antennas up, it becomes a whole different ballgame, particularly if they're wire antennas, because it's sort of a bit messy. But it did work, and I was pretty happy with the results on the tests that I was doing. Some of the tests that I do when I put up a new antenna like this, quite often it's QRP testing. I'll get on there with 1 watt, and I'll see if I can work the world. And if I can't work the world with 1 watt, then I know the antenna's probably not doing what I'd like it to do. But I had a lot of QSOs with 1 watt with the US and Europe for about a week or so after the contest. And then I took the tower down because we were off to Japan for a couple of weeks, and I didn't really want to leave the tower up there whilst we were away. So I took the antenna down. And you know, that was back in early December, and the antenna so far is still, and I'm still working on it. So, but look, again, it's part of the hobby. I'll get there.
Oh, but hey, Kevin, have you happened to notice that, speaking of transmit antenna evaluation, have you seen that very latest video I put up about using the Kiwi radio with the S meter extension to evaluate transmit antennas?
No, I haven't seen that. I saw it on there, but I knew we were going to talk today about the BOGs and the BOLs. So I did a little bit of homework on that first, but I saw that one. And I thought, yeah, that's a good one as well.
Sure. Well, no, yeah. check it out, because honestly, it's not new. I think a lot of people are aware of it, but it's really, Kevin, honestly, I think you might really benefit from using that method. I mean, anyone can use it. I mean, it's a great way to evaluate transmit antennas, because you don't need anything other than your PC sitting beside you. And I mean, you can literally build an azimuth polar plot of your transmit antenna, okay, assuming you can rotate it, and assuming you can find a Kiwi proximal that's giving you a stable signal source. But anyway, check that out. I think you might really enjoy that to evaluate your antenna experiments.
That'd be good. Once I get the X beam stuck up again, I'll do that. But one of the advantages with the X beam is that this is the antenna I can electrically rotate to 360 degrees with relays from the shack. So there's no rotator involved at all. And the 2/2 is, you know, 2/2 over 2/2 stacked and optimized on NEC. It gives pretty good gain, but the main advantage with it is the gain is at a nice low angle. It's got a good polar diagram at a low angle, which is exactly what I need living in VK6, trying to work DX or trying to work contests or whatever. So, but it's really nice to be able to turn the switch and flick around the different directions without having, you know, heavy duty rotators involved. So that was the main motivation in building the X beam and then stacking them and seeing what I could really achieve with that. The X beam on its own, the polar pattern is not great, but as soon as you stack it 2/2, the whole thing starts to look a little bit more impressive.
Yeah, you push your wave angle down.
Yeah, absolutely. It tidies up the side. It gets rid of the high angle. So if you've got a 2/15 and 10 meter beam up at 24-25 meters, you do get a little, because of the ground reflection, you do get a little bit of high angle there. As soon as you stack it, it eliminates the high angle and narrows the beam down. And yeah, it's a lot of pluses. So that's an HF band project. It's got nothing to do with 160 per se, but all of this stuff is interesting, and it's interesting to do the modeling and just to try and then evaluate whether or not you feel that on air you're getting close to it, because you've taken it a step further with the drones and and plotting the polar diagram. But yes, I'll have a look. I'll have a look at that latest one of yours. That would be really good, really good. So, and some of my stuff I've been posting on Instagram as well. I've got an Instagram feed or channel, or whatever you like to call it. It's just VK6LW, and I've put some of the stuff on there. There's quite a few HF operators on there actually. They're following and some interesting. Some other interesting people that I'm following that have got videos and clips on Instagram, because it's all quite quick. You're limited to about a minute 30, I think, on Instagram in terms of a video clip. But you can condense quite a bit of information into that minute 30, and then it's because I'll link everything back to this podcast, and so they can have a listen to other things I'm discussing. So yeah, just a way to keep in touch with people, and also quite a bit of CW related content on there as well.
Well, I'll follow you on Instagram. I also have an Instagram account, but I don't use it. I haven't used it in a long time. I'll follow my daughter. She's
Yeah,
got, but yeah.
take a look. Yeah, there's I've got about I think I started this probably about 6 months ago, and I've put more than 100 posts on there so far. So it's quite varied. Some of it's antenna stuff, some of it's CW. Some it's equipment, it's you know, pictures of some of the things I've been working on in the past, bandpass filters, all that sort of stuff. But yes, it's worthwhile having a look. It's you know, find something on there that is of interest for sure. So maybe what I need to do then is link it to a YouTube channel. Take it to the next level like you have.
Then you won't have any time at all for radio.
I'll never be on the radio now.
Yeah.
I'm retired, Steve, you know, like yourself. So, in technically speaking, I have got enough time for this. But yeah, our days are busy, you know. Life is busy, which is great, and radio is part of that reason, I think. Yeah, for sure. Anyway, I think we'll wrap it up there, Steve. And it's getting pretty late here. I'm not sure what the local time is. Oh, it's just a bit after midnight, so might wrap things up, and we'll maybe plan another episode with the information about the switching and the some of the control mechanisms you've developed there for the remote station, because there's a lot of people out there with remote stations. There's a lot of people interested in remote, so that's something that, you know, whether or not they're low band operators or not, they still would have an interest in some of those control systems that you're testing and developing and working out. So that would be a good one.
Sure. Well, no, hey, I would enjoy it. It's always a pleasure to have a chat with you.
My thanks to Steve, VE6WZ, for joining me on this podcast. Steve's got a great YouTube channel. Just search VE6WZ. Lots of information on there about receive antennas, transmit antennas, low band operating, and some interesting construction projects. 73s for now from me, Kevin, VK6 Lima Whiskey, and thanks for listening to this podcast.